Employees Retirement Association. Please call the roll.
Okay, Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Ron Martin. Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Joan Clendenin. We have a quorum.
Hey, are there any announcements?
I have one announcement. Although she's not here, I was kind of hoping she'd be here. And let you know that Joyce Parker, our IT person, is retiring next month. She's got over 30 years of service with the county, and she started here at Stansera in 2005. And she was very instrumental in getting the Tyler system up to speed. So we want to congratulate her.
Okay. Thank you. Any other announcements? Okay, seeing none, we will go to public comment. Anybody from the board wish to comment something that is not about anything that's not on the agenda? Anybody from our audience wish to make a public comment? Okay, seeing none, we will go to the consent items.
Move to approve the consent items.
Motion's been made. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, the motion is made and seconded to approve the consent items. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion is carried. Await item 6A, Executive Director's Report, Board Study Session.
All right, item 6A, this is a board study session. We're going to talk about today where contribution rates are going and funding ratios are going in the future. Probably the easiest way to understand where the contribution rates are going is to look at it visually. There are a lot of ways you can model risk, but this seems to me to be the easiest way to do it. So what we're going to look at is we're going to look at the uncertainty in contribution rates through the year 2020 and the uncertainty in where funding ratios are going to go in 2020. And we'll also look at what might happen to the risk profile and contribution rates if we make some of the GASB recommendation changes, and also if we decide to lower the discount rate at some point in time, and if we choose to invest less aggressively. These types of presentations, I'll tell you right up front, I've given these types of presentations before, and they either go very well or they either go very poorly. So I'm hoping that this is going to be a good one. Lately I've had good luck, but sometimes these don't always work out the way you plan.
Not good.
I figured I'd just put that little caveat in there.
What kind of outcome are you looking for?
Just for you to understand.
So,
what this, I've got two programs here that at work to generate these functions of risk. One of the programs I have is from Graham Schmidt from EFI. He's in the audience today. And he allows us to model contribution rates and funding ratios based on expected returns over the next several years. And so what that does is it requires the user to go in and put in the expected return for each year. I added a little something to that, and I'll pull that up really fast and show you. We won't spend a lot of time on this. So here's Graham's spreadsheet, and you can see Graham, some of the input that he has here are market returns for the next 20 years, or 10 years, I'm sorry, 8 to 10 years. What this other sheet does here is it actually generates random investment returns based on the way we invest right now. And you can set the expected return and the risk factor here in this column. And you'll see, I've got to get my glasses on here. You'll see that every time I hit this little iterative button that it'll generate different returns for the next through 2021. And the reason I'm showing you this is I want you to see one thing. Even though we're expected to return 8% over this period of time, but it's not always the case that even in the short to intermediate term that you're going to earn 8%. And you can see here on average, this scenario of returns for the next 8 to 10 years nets you only 5.8%. This one, 12.7. There's a 9.8. So you can see the tremendous volatility, not only from year to year in trying to achieve that assumption, but also over the next 5 to 10 years.
How are you doing the random generation?
Yeah, that's
right. It uses a normal distribution. And it generates, if you want to see, do you really want to see that?
What kind of parameters? I assume you've got a maximum.
A normal distribution only has two parameters. It has the mean and the standard deviation, and that's what these two are, the expected return and the expected risk. There are some caveats to it, and I'll let you know as soon as I go back to the PowerPoint. So one of the...
This?
Pardon me?
Mylar.
What's that?
When will we get here?
We're gonna, I just want to show you this, kind of to give you an idea of what the program is doing. And so what Graham's program then does, it generates scenarios of contribution rates through 2020. And so what you'll see is, let me give you an idea here of what it's doing. So if I stop this really fast. So this is one scenario right here. So in this scenario, we're always starting at 18%. And this scenario, unfortunately, takes us to an... That's a pretty high one. I've not seen one quite that high. Here's one that takes us up to around 28%, comes back down, and here's another one that remains relatively flat. So these are possible scenarios or paths of contribution rates that can occur based on the way we invest. And so if I go ahead and run through the whole thing, this does 40 examples. You can start to get an idea of how uncertain contribution rates are in the future, and you can see how it gets wider the farther out you go. So theoretically, any of these paths are equally likely to occur over the next 8 to 10 years. And that's all we'll look at in this. But I just kind of wanted to show you what the spreadsheets were doing and how we were feeding his spreadsheet information and what we were getting back. So what the program is going to do then, it's going to generate 1,000 scenarios in the background, which you don't see and we don't really want to see, and it's going to generate a probability distribution. And it's there's a lot of information in this distribution, and in this example here, this is a distribution of future employer contribution rates, and it's got the 75th and the 50th percentile line. There's a lot of information here. This says that in the year 2020, the 75th percentile has employer rates at about 34%. What that means is that there's a 75% chance that in 2020, 3 in 4 chance, that your rate's going to be lower than 34%. It also means that there's a 1 in 4 chance that the rate's going to be higher than 34% in 2020. The 50th percentile line is what's expected to happen. And this would be the, probably, if the actuary had to make a best guess, he's going to tell you that your rate in 2020 is going to be 26% based on whatever scenario this distribution is based on. There's one other thing that this distribution tells you. It also says that since you've got the 75th percentile line and the 50th percentile line there, there's a 25% chance or a 1 in 4 chance that in 2020 the rate will be somewhere between 34 and 26%. So what we'll see is the wider these fans are, the wider these lines are, the more uncertainty there is in the contribution rates later on down the road. Some of the limitations is that this only models investment return uncertainty. It doesn't do a good job, it doesn't do a job at all, of capturing the relationship between the actuary, the rate that the actuary sets and the resulting employer action. A lot of times we've seen in the past that when the rate starts to trend up, the employer reacts and starts to cut back on payroll. This model, I'm sure I'm right here, I didn't ask Graham this, but this model continues just to assume that the payroll is going to grow at the assumed rate. And so it doesn't capture that relationship well. It doesn't model the events like 2008, 2009 very well, like we saw. And one of the best way to explain that is that a lot of times there's correlation between returns between investment years. Like if one year's bad, there's a higher probability that the next year is going to be bad. This assumes that there's independence between the returns from year to year. And then it assumes that there's no gains and losses on the actuarial side. But what I want to tell you is that none of these limitations really detract from what you're going to see today. It's not perfect, but it still gives you a good idea of how certain, uncertain, and how volatile contribution rates are and funded ratios are.
But everything is still dependent upon your basic assumptions.
Absolutely.
Which means the numbers you're generating, I still don't understand. Are you generating around an assumed zero average?
No, 8%.
8%
average? So we take the bell curve, and it's got a mean of 8% and a standard deviation of about 11%, and it randomly generates returns from that distribution. So it's going to... it's going to more so give you a return close to 8% because most of the weight in that distribution is centered around 8%. But it can still give you extreme returns out on the tails of that distribution.
Right. So you're saying over the next 5 years, our employer contribution rate is likely to go from 18 to up to 34, premised only on our 8% rate of return.
That's just an example. We're going to get to your answer, your question, right, probably now. So in scenarios 1, 2, and 3, we're going to look at probability distributions, and we're going to look at it in terms of the way we currently do business. So in other words, we're going to be using an 8% discount rate. We're going to assume an amortization period of 25 years declining to 15, and we're going to have a funding policy that's non-GASB suggested at this point in time. And we're going to look at three scenarios. We're going to look at if the portfolio earns 8% expected. Remember, there's still that variation that can occur through 2020, if it earns 7%, and if it earns 6%. Because I know that there's a lot of talk about the discount rate, and I think the best way to look at, you know, what it is we do is look at it in terms of what may happen if we don't actually achieve what we are expected to achieve. So here's the first probability distribution. And we can run through these fast, because I think what you'll see is once you get a feel for this, what you'll notice is that not much changes here. And this is the only graph where you're going to see the percentiles marked. You see that you've got the 95th percentile and so forth all the way down to the 5th percentile. So this is the way we do business right now, and this is if the portfolio earns on average 8% through the year 2020. And you can see, Mike, in this scenario that the rates are expected to trend up to 21%. And the reason that is because of the amortization policy that the board has put into place. That we're going to start cutting down on that amortization period from 25 down to 15. And that's why the rates are going to be trending up if everything happens the way we think they're going to happen. A couple things I want to point out here is that there's still a 1 in 20 chance, a 5% chance, that rates could actually be above 43%. There's also a greater than a 5% chance that the rates could be zero in 2020. And in fact, there's about a 5% chance that the rates in 6 years from now could be zero. But the thing that I want you to take away from this is there is a lot of uncertainty in contribution rates going forward. And it's mostly due to the way that the system invests their assets. Almost all of this volatility is due to the way we invest. So that's kind of what we're up against. If we earn on average 7% through 2020, you can see the rates on average are expected to trend up to about 26%. And you can see even the uncertainty or the width of the 95th and the 5th percentile bands gets even wider, which means there is even more uncertainty.
Part of that is because of what we carry from the past, or is that just based on future?
This is based on going forward.
As if we have no carry forward or problem from the past?
It does include the unfunded liability.
Okay. So yes. Part of it then is the unfunded liability.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. And see, what's happening is if we go back one slide, this is if we earn what we think we're going to earn. We know that that's trending up to 21% because of the amortization policy. Go forward to 7%. The difference between the 21 and 26 represents actuarial losses on the portfolio that the actuary is building into the rates because on average we're only earning 7% through 2020. And then the 6% scenario, we only earn 6% on average through 2020. We could be looking at rates that are 10% higher 20 years down the road on average. It's interesting to note here that even if the portfolio on average were expected to earn 6% through 2020, there are still scenarios where the rate could be zero. It's not likely to happen very much. But one of the interesting things about this slide is you'll notice that if the portfolio on average does earn 6% through 2020, there's a 1 in 4 chance that the rates are going to be what they are or lower. And so that means that the 25th percentile, it's pretty much a flat line between rates now and what they are in the future. In other words, there's a 3/4 chance that our rates are going to be greater than what they are now if we only earn 6%. And then real fast, we'll buzz through the funded ratios. This is what the funding ratio is expected to be based on our current assumptions, and if we earn 8%, it's expected to trend up slightly to 80%.
You can see 8% over the next 6-7 years.
Right.
To stay at 80.
To just trend up slightly to 80. Yes. We're not. You got to realize that we're not shaving much off that unfunded liability, and the unfunded liability is still growing. Even though we are lowering the amortization period, because it doesn't start decreasing until we hit, what, about 17, 18 years?
As a dollar amount.
Right. So the unfunded liability is going to continue to grow until we get under that 17, 18-year amortization period.
So we have to get 8% a year just to stay even?
Pretty much, on the funded ratio side.
And does that take into account that the employees are going to stay constant, or they're going to go up?
It assumes
they went down quite a bit,
right,
lately.
It assumes flat salaries for another couple of years.
Flat salaries and a level workforce for the next 2 years,
right.
And then after the 2 years, it assumes that pay will start to grow again at 3.5%. But it always assumes a constant workforce from the date that we measured, which was June 30th, 2007.
Can you repeat that? Constant workforce all the time?
We assume that every time somebody retires or leaves, they're going to be replaced by a new hire, so that your active workforce, the number of people actively working, is assumed to be the same over time.
No assumed growth in population and...
No assumed growth in the active population. Your retiree population is assumed to grow, right?
Yeah.
Because you have people living longer, and they're going to, you know, as they retire, they'll add to the retiree population until they're projected to...
But normally, over a long period of time, wouldn't you assume population growth and also workplace growth of some small amount?
In general, for public employment systems, the answer is generally actually no. You try the baseline assumption is generally an active level workforce. You can build in projections to an increasing workforce, but the baseline assumption that GASB, for instance, asks you to look at when you're trying to amortize things as a percentage of pay, is to assume a level workforce.
But that's a more conservative approach.
I've seen workforces going in the opposite direction in the last 5 years, so I don't know whether I'm characterizing it as conservative or optimistic.
It does.
How long you're going out.
It does assume consistent payroll growth, though, overall total payroll growth going forward.
In dollar growth, not
in
personnel.
Right.
Wait a minute. You always assume that a new employee replaces a retired employee?
For purposes of doing these types of projections, yes. For the valuation, we're only looking at your workforce today.
Okay. Thank you.
So moving on with the funded ratios, if we earn 7%, you can see the funded ratio is going to trend down to 75%. And you start to see that the odds of hitting 100% funded over the next 8 to 10 years start to become remote, because you're looking at something greater than or less than 25% that you're going to hit 100% funded. And at 6%, you're looking at a funded ratio that trends down to around 70% and becoming even more remote that we reach that magic 100% funded, if that's what the goal is. So that's just a summary of the subpar asset returns. In the next scenario, we're going to look at what happens if we change to GASB. And one of the things, we don't even have to spend a lot of time here. One of the things you'll see is that it doesn't really change our risk profile much. We're still going to have as much uncertainty as we had if we left things alone. However, it does pump more cash into the system. So it will prop up the system somewhat and make it more sustainable, I guess, is the best word going forward. But here you see, what you really see is just a shift upward in the contribution rate of about 2%, and you still see that rate trending upward due to the amortization policy, and you have just about a wide spread in the uncertainty. There's not a whole lot that's interesting about. Yes?
When you say increase in the employer contribution rate,
mm-hmm.
are you saying that it increases because there are increased employees, or because the rate that the employer is required to pay is increased?
The rate that the employer is required to pay is higher. And there's a simple explanation for that. Let me go to the funded ratio, because that's probably a better context to explain it in. You see here the contribution rate is going up, but when you implement these GASB changes, the funded ratio increases by 5%. And that's simply due to the methodology. GASB accounts, they say that there's more of the attribute more of the total benefit that's going to be paid to future costs and less of it to past service that's earned. So you have less liability when you make these changes to GASB because, again, it apportions the total value of the benefits differently than the current methods do. You can apportion the total value of a benefit either to future costs that the employer will pay into the future or past costs. Well, what this does, this new method, assumes that more of the costs are shifted to future employer contributions, which is why the rate goes up, and less of it is due to past contributions, which is why there's less liability and the funded ratios increase. And can you explain that any better?
I guess when you push it into the future cost, it basically means you're amortizing that cost over the expected working lifetime of the employee, which is probably around 10 to 12 years. If you consider it to be past costs, you're spreading it, you're amortizing it as part of your unfunded liability, which currently you're doing that over 25 years. So the reason the cost is going up is just because you're paying off that liability over a shorter period of time, i.e. the employee's career, rather than over a 25-year period.
It's just a different way of apportioning the pie of the total benefits that the employees are going to receive. Yes?
I think from what I've observed is that employees don't stay with the county now or any employer as they used to, that there are shorter spans of employment. Is that factored in or am I off base?
That is factored in. Every 3 years we do what's called an experience study where we review the actual behavior of the members. We look at how frequently and at what ages people retire or if they leave before they have a retirement benefit. And every 3 years we look at the assumptions that we're using to project future member behavior, and to the extent that our assumptions are, you know, good or bad, you know, reflect or don't reflect, we make adjustments to those assumptions going forward.
Thank you.
An ongoing process of adjustment.
And then secondly, we're going to look at the change to the discount rate if we were to lower it to 7.5%. Again, we'll find the same as we found for the GASB. It doesn't change the funding risk much, but it does produce more cash and throw more cash into the plan. And you can see that if we lower the discount rate by 0.5%, you're looking at about a 4% increase in rate with those rates trending up on average. And you're also looking at a drop in funded ratio of about 5%, and that funded ratio trending up to about 76% over time. So here's this is the last part of the presentation. This is the very interesting part of the presentation. We ask ourselves the question, what happens if we change the way we invest and we start to invest with an eye more towards the liabilities in mind? In other words, essentially we're starting to take some of that asset risk off the table in the way we fund the benefits. And this program is assuming, a little unrealistically right now, I can't drop the discount rate lower than 6% in this program, so it's assuming essentially that interest rates are about 150 basis points higher than what they are currently, and if they were about 150 basis points higher than what they are now, we could take a lot of the risk off the table. And it's not such a far-fetched thing to assume that 30-year treasuries couldn't reach 5%. They've been 5%, well above 5% many points in time. So we're assuming here that interest rates are about 150 to 200 basis points higher. And if they are, and we decided to pull a lot of the risk off the table, this is what you'd be looking at. Now, this is a pretty hefty cost, and let me tell you that there are many, many scenarios in between where we are now and where full-blown immunization could take us. Okay, and also, right now, in the current interest rate environment that we're in right now, it's extremely expensive to take risk off the table. The lower interest rates are, the more expensive it becomes to start to deleverage your portfolio. So the sentiment that I want to leave you with here is that there may be opportunities in the future as interest rates start to rise and it becomes cheaper to deleverage the portfolio and pay for those liabilities, that there may be some opportunities where we can remove some of the risk from the portfolio and it won't be as expensive as you see right here. This is obviously unrealistic. There's no way that anybody can assume a doubling in the employer rates to get a risk profile like this. But nonetheless, this is what you'd be looking at later on down the road. If one were able to pull a lot of the risk off the table, you could see a tremendous decrease in the volatility of employer contribution rates out there. And here's funded ratios. Interesting about this is you drop immediately down to 59%, but you notice that there's no scenario where funded ratios drop. You're always improving your funded ratio going forward, which is one of the beauties of investing with an eye towards liabilities in mind.
Now, that wouldn't be possible with the collar?
An interest rate collar?
Well,
you mean it cheaper?
I mean, you can't drop down to that kind of a level of funded ratio, right?
You can. I guess my point to you is that if the board were to decide later on to start to employ some of these strategies, that it's done very methodically and very slowly over time. Again, there's many, many. Let's look at this last slide here. So this is the our risk profile today. And so this is kind of what you get for your money, essentially. And you can see that the uncertainty drops dramatically by going from here to here. And again, the point that I want to make is that there are many, many scenarios in between here and here. And as second tiers start to kick in down the road, 15 to 20 years, the cost is going to come down as well. The fact that people will be retiring later, it'll push the payment of the liabilities out farther, which will make it a little cheaper to be able to leverage and fund or deleverage and fund those liabilities in the future. So you've got two things working for you that's going to make this picture change over time and bring this profile down. It's second tiers, and it's also the fact that interest rates are extraordinarily high right now.
Say that again.
There's one of the reasons why this picture, you've got this risk profile, this contribution rate profile so high, is because interest rates are so low right now. So there's two things that are going to bring it down in the future. As interest rates start to climb, this whole profile will start to shift downward. And then as your second tiers start to kick in, this will shift down a little bit, not a whole lot, but it will start to bring it down just a little bit if it extends the duration or the payment times of the liabilities a little farther out. It allows you to go out farther on the yield curve to be able to pay those benefits because they won't be paid for a period farther out in time. So it'll start to bring that risk profile down a little bit, too. So this is what we're up against.
What is the average time that a retiree, the average time that a retiree draws retirement post-retirement?
I don't know the exact number, but
my guess would be 20 years?
I'm thinking somewhere in 18 to 20 years.
Yeah.
20 to 25?
I think 25 might be, well, maybe safety members. Yeah, absolutely.
Safety and females.
And females.
Yay.
Well, doesn't that reduce the benefit from the impact of Tier 2 because you still have so many Tier 1 folks around?
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying is that over time, as those Tier 2s kick in, it'll become less expensive to...
But you're talking maybe 25.
Yeah, you're looking 15, 20 years down the road.
Tier 2 is actually already, when we've done the projections, remember I said that when somebody retires, they're replaced by a new hire? Well, we've built it so that they're replaced by a new Tier 2 hire.
Okay.
So to some extent, a lot of that's already
okay,
built
good.
In
all
right. Protections.
That's a good point. I didn't realize that.
Thank you.
So, any other questions?
Clearly, as we go along, if we are on either the high or low extreme, our adjustments will pull it back.
Yes. Yeah. Again, the biggest thing that's affecting the cost to start to invest less aggressively and to be able to fund those liabilities with less volatility is low interest rates. It's killing us. It's killing everybody right now. I mean, I'm sure you've heard that people in the pension world talking about how expensive it is to fund benefits these days, And that's exactly why. Fixed income is paying very little right now. I mean, could you imagine in the early 80s if interest rates rose to 15% like they were then, what you could do? You'd have enough money to pay benefits almost twice over.
You only knew. The problem is they committed to
inflation.
Paying them three
right.
times over.
Right. But the point is it was very cheap to be able to insure your benefits at that point in time. Extremely cheap. So just because things are the way they are now doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be opportunities later on down the road.
Or said another way, this is not the time to do it.
If I were advising you, I would say this is a very difficult time to do this. Although you could start down the path, you know, as we talk about lowering the discount rate over the next month or two, then, you know, we could start to talk about some strategies and how we implement that and what we would do to the portfolio going forward.
I think you've also, and some of you have heard this at other sessions, we've done a presentation about the concept that Bob McCrory talked about, stable funding. And that is, if you get in a situation where you have some good investments on your, good returns on your equity portfolio, and you get to a better funded position, once you get to that better funded position, that's when a good time to maybe take some of the chips off the table.
And I'm going to be bringing that concept forward in a couple months with your help that you don't know about yet. And that's all I have on this.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Rick.
It's very good. Sure. Turn the lights on, and we will now go to 6B.
Please. Thank you.
Actuarial Review and Analysis by EFI.
Good afternoon. Nice to see you all again. So you have a copy of the bound document. Anybody wants to make a Pulitzer Prize recommendation, we'd be happy to accept them. I'm sure it's been great reading for you. But I actually, rather than going through the full document, this year we've given you cliff notes, too. So you should have in front of you just a four-page folded sheet. I did bring new copies of that. There was one in your packet, but this is a new copy that just reflects a change to the graph. We're calling this evaluation at a glance, and we are eager to find out if you guys find this useful, if you would like this in future years, if you think this is a good way to present the information, or if you have any requests for changes to this document. But really, what's in this really summarizes the main parts that I'd like to go through in the report. If you have specific questions of things that you've seen in the report, I'd be happy to answer those as well.
So can we go through assumptions first?
Sure. That would be on the back page of the summary presentation, labeled actual cost method, and it lists the major assumptions that we're using in terms of investment return, inflation, and salary growth.
Okay, so as I read your document, you're assuming a 6% reduction applied to all employees?
Not to all, I think almost all employees. I think there were a couple bargaining units that we did not, that had not yet signed a different agreement yet.
Two-thirds of our employees at this time?
We were instructed, though, that while we were close, you already had a 5% reduction in effect for most employees.
Which expires in June.
Right. And then the replacement agreement, which reflected a 6% permanent adjustment rather than a 5% temporary reduction, was going to go into effect for most bargaining units after the 5% reduction expired.
That's definitely an optimistic assumption. Has not been agreed to.
Well, I talked about this with officials, and what I got from them is more likely than not, early in the fiscal year 2012-2013, it would apply to all bargaining groups. That's the discussions that I've had.
That's what they're trying to achieve.
Right.
But they're having some problem getting there.
Well, I talked to them in December, late November, early December. So it's been a while. But that's when Graham was finalizing the evaluation.
Well, and to the extent that
how sensitive is that?
Remarkably not very sensitive.
Okay.
As a percentage of payroll, what happens is if that doesn't happen and the cost and we don't see that reduction in the payroll, you wouldn't necessarily see a large change in the cost as a percentage of pay, but the payroll base that you're contributing on would be larger, so the plan will be collecting more money. There will be probably some increase in the cost as a percentage of pay, and as we go through how costs have changed from last year to this year, I'll show you where that, you know, where that assumption in particular has had an impact, but I wouldn't expect that it would be more than, say, a percentage of pay. To go back to the front, just the front tab is really supposed to give you a snapshot in time, last year versus this year. On the left side, we're looking at last year, the results as of June 30th, 2010. On the right, you're looking at the results as of June 30th, 2011. We're looking in the top row at the accrued liability, which hasn't changed very much from last year to this year, about $1.7 billion. That would be the one area where, if you didn't see a reduction in pay, that number would go up. Funded ratio has improved both on a smooth basis and on a market basis from last year to this year. It went up from 76.3 to 78.1% on the smooth value of assets. It went up a lot more on the market value of assets, right? Because you had a really good return last year. It went up from 64.6 to 78.1%. So the unfunded liability number, that actually dropped as a dollar amount from $412 million to $386 million. And remember, we've talked about this concept before, the inactive actuarial liability. That's the liability associated with people who are no longer working for the county and the special districts, right? These are people who are retired, disabled, beneficiaries who are receiving benefits, people who have left and are getting a deferred and are eligible for a deferred benefit, everybody except your active employees. That $960 million, that's the liability associated with those members. So as long as your assets are greater than that number, it means that you at least have put aside enough assets to fund the benefits for the retirees as long as they're projected to live. I have some plans where that is not true.
Is that a big increase for 1 year, 99?
In inactive accrued liability, no, especially in the circumstances we're seeing now where people are retiring early, you're having reductions in your workforce. So anytime somebody, you know, if you're laying somebody off or you have a reduction in their workforce, their liability, whether or not they're receiving that benefit right now, is going from active to the inactive category. The numbers that everybody over here is probably interested to see, the contribution rate, that has actually gone down slightly as a percentage of payroll from 18.65% for the county members to 17.73%, and for Ceres and the other special districts, that number actually went up slightly. The net rate, which is almost totally, you know, which is really based on the county's results, went down from 18.6 to 17.83%. And the expected plan year cost, which is based on our actuarial projections of payroll, is about $40 million. Now we go through our gain loss. How do we get from last year to this year? Right, it's the story we want to tell in the valuation. Last year, the contribution rate was 18.6. How did it get to 17.83? The first category we look at is the demographic experience of the plan. How do the number of retirements, terminations, disabilities, back to your question about, you know, do we look at our assumptions every year? How did that compare to the assumptions we had? And the plan experience in general was positive, which generally means bad things for people because it means, a lot of times, it means more people have died than we expected, right? That can reduce plan costs. Or to the extent that the COLAs haven't gone up as anticipated. The number here that would be reflected would be your COLA that was granted last year, not the one that you received this year. And last year's COLA wasn't as high as our assumed COLA rate, so that's another gain for the plan. Payroll also grew by less than the assumed rate of 3.75%. And since the unfunded liability is amortized in dollars, but then spread over payroll, if the cost didn't go up, if the payroll didn't go up as much as expected, you'll see an increase in the cost as a percentage of pay, not necessarily because the dollar amount went up. Investment experience, we had a 22.1 market percent return, so that's tough to call negative experience, but remember, we're offsetting this by the delayed recognition of the 2009 investment losses under the smoothing program. We're smoothing gains and losses over a 5-year period. And that resulted in the actuarial value of assets only returning 3.5%, which increased the cost of the plan by 1.4% of pay. From last year to this year, you kept the amortization period at 25 years. In essence, you basically refinanced the debt over a new 25-year period, and by doing so, that reduced the sponsor's cost by about 0.3% of pay. Again, we built into our projections an assumption of a 6% pay reduction, and sorry, not a 2-year, but a 3-year pay freeze, and that yielded a decrease in the contribution rate of less than 1%. So, Gordon, back to your question, if not all the bargaining units, if we hadn't used that set of assumptions, the cost wouldn't have gone down by that full 0.95%. But given that I think a large number, some of your employees have already agreed to that, I don't know that it would be, that much of an impact if we didn't use that assumption.
If it was only 1/3 that agreed, would it be? Well, one third of the change?
It's not necessarily just the 1/3 that agrees. It's to the extent that a big part of this assumption is that we're assuming no pay growth over the next 3 years, right? So even if they didn't agree to a 6% pay cut, would they be anticipating raises over the next 3 years that otherwise would be built into our projections? So I think even if they didn't agree to a 6% pay cut, you'd probably still get some of. As time goes on,
so
you'll be getting some of this.
Maybe like half of it or something?
Tough to tell.
Is that a tough calculation if you had some figures?
You would have to also, along with, we need to know everybody's pay now.
Right.
Right.
That's easy. That's a given.
Which would take some work
yeah.
in terms of calculations. And then we would also need to know what's their expected pay growth over the next couple of years.
So if we had a several-year agreement in place, then you could do it.
Yes, but it's not an easy thing to break those up into different. It's much easier to do one assumption for the group as a whole than to divide it up into separate groups with different payroll assumptions.
Give me a rough idea of difficulty.
We probably wouldn't do it. We probably wouldn't try to break up the different groups. You would probably try to come up with an average across all your groups of employees.
Okay, so.
And I don't think it would, again, I don't think it would affect the employer's contribution rate as a percentage of pay very much. What it will do is it will change the dollar amount that's being received by the system because the employer is contributing this percentage of pay times their actual pensionable payroll. So to the extent that you have more pay, the system will collect more money. I mean, at this stage in the process, in order to get contribution rates to your employer before the end of the fiscal year, I don't think we can really make any changes in terms of this assumption to the actuarial evaluation.
We had talked about maybe making some assumptions about 2/3 of the group getting the pay decrease, 1/3 not, but it got too complicated. This is the actuarial evaluation is as of a point in time, and we're always in flux and transitioning. So next year when Graham does the valuation, things are probably going to be more cemented. And any rightness or wrongness that occurred because of this assumption will be made up next year. So it's just a transitory thing. It's not a big deal. And I can't imagine, like Graham said, that it's going to affect the contribution rate that much. And there is the mitigating point that Graham brought up, is that even if they don't get this pay decrease, the county is going to be paying contributions on this higher payroll than expected, which is going to be bringing more dollars into the system.
To some extent, that would be an offsetting gain that would
right.
offset the loss
yeah.
from the...
So it's kind of a push.
So then I need to get a better understanding of what could be adjusted and couldn't be adjusted before we finalize everything.
I mean, at this point, to do a new set of calculation numbers...
of this detail would be hard. More general, huge changes could be taken.
Things like changes to the amortization policy.
And give me an idea of what's possible, what isn't.
I guess, Gordon, where are you going with this? I mean, what's the intent?
I'm trying to get an idea of what we have as the ability to make a decision or not make a decision. Do we have flexibility? Are we going to simply say, we can't change anything, that's it, goodbye? Are we going to be able to make any changes at all?
Well, that's why you have negotiations. But if you're...
No, I mean in what we're talking about, because he said for
Right, but what you, if
final
you,
figures for June, between March and June, there's very little that can be done.
In terms of a recalculation of the actual evaluation, that's correct. In terms of recalculation of the liabilities, there are some changes that we could make quickly, like a change to the amortization policy.
Okay.
Your 25-year period, if you were to, if you said you wanted to use a different period than that, we could come back with a different employer contribution rate.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get at. Okay.
It just seems to me that it's kind of a relatively small variable that we're dealing here, really.
Well, the question I have is,
major decision.
The question is, I have is a, I had a bunch of questions about assumptions, and I gather what I'm saying is, right or wrong, it doesn't matter. We're going to live with what we got.
Well, unless
right
we
on.
Find something
that's
yes.
egregiously yeah. wrong, right?
Right. If there's if there's sure. something where we are using
that's
pay that's off by
right.
you know, half of somebody's pay, then you know I think we would need to revisit that.
So when I see on page 66, we strongly recommend employer verify this schedule. There's no purpose to verify the schedule. I just don't understand.
Where are you?
Page 66.
Say that again.
66.
When we say, is this the historical funded status?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just reading documents, trying to figure out. Okay,
this,
do we need
this
to
is
do
historical.
Something?
Is
there,
that's a historical set of. It's a historical set of results compiled from prior reports. So that's not something that you
so
verify the actual.
Well, why would you say we strongly recommend you verify?
Because we took over from another actuary and we used the information in their report, so we want to make sure that somebody made sure we brought forward those numbers back. It's kind of language that's generally this is left in this schedule.
So it's not something you want us to verify.
I can verify it if
no,
we
I just don't know whether we're doing anything or not.
No, I've looked at the past valuation reports for the last 15 years,
okay.
So I've already looked
okay.
at this, but I haven't purposefully tried to verify this, but it would be something that would be very easy to do.
I just find it strange language if we're not going
to
do anything.
Is it boilerplate
to some extent,
or liability?
It's boilerplate language from the actuarial standpoint.
Because they didn't generate these figures. EFI didn't generate these figures.
I will say if you look at the actual certification,
right.
almost that entire page is boilerplate language that we have to have in there as the actuarial standards practice.
Okay. Then I'm tripping myself up on language I shouldn't read. Okay.
Gordon, you'd be tripping.
You got it. I got a lot of tripping. And I guess I shouldn't be reading it.
Okay, then the very last change, the actuarial value of assets was reset to equal the market value of assets. You know how we talk about keeping your actuarial value of assets within a certain percentage of your market value? We talk about this corridor around your market value of assets. Well, lo and behold, this year your actuarial value of assets was 100.00% of your market value of assets. You still had some deferred gains and losses, but they balanced each other out. So what we said was, let's wipe out the prior gains and losses so you don't see the contribution rate go up one year and then come back down the next year. We sent a memo to your administrator explaining sort of the reasons for our change. It affected costs almost negligibly by 0.02% of pay. That should even out some of the bumps in the road. This next page, page 2, is the top of the interior. This is not necessarily shown in the valuation report, but you have seen this information both from us and from Rick. I have to say I'm very impressed. I've never seen anybody take our, you know, take such a good care of our projection spreadsheet and make it such good use out of it, so I'm really happy to see that. The projections, right, the projections on the bottom of this page, the left and the right, those are showing the deterministic projections that he was showing randomly in the last presentation. So the bottom left projection, that's showing a projection of cost as a percentage of payroll. And this isn't doing any kind of simulation. This is just assuming that you earn exactly 8% every year. And you can see it goes from, you know, about 18% to around 20% in 10 years, almost exactly, you know, very close to his simulated midpoint, which was going from 18 up to, I think, 21%. So you can see this gives a good confirmation of what Rick was doing. It says, okay, if we just assume that you're actually earning 8% every year, how does that projection look? And it looks very similar to what he was showing as part of his midpoint simulations, right? And again, you're seeing the contribution rate over time start to come down. As your amortization period gets short enough, as it gets down to about 15 years, you start to pay off the unfunded liability, and the contribution rate starts to come back down to the level of just the normal cost. But it takes a long time to get there. Bottom right graph, we're showing the projection of the funded ratio based on the, and we're here where it doesn't really matter whether we're using the smooth value of the assets or the market value of assets, because lo and behold, they're now the same thing. And now, and that red line that is shown in that bottom right graph, again, that's the inactive only funded ratio. So as long as you're above that line, it means you at least have enough assets set aside for your current retirees. The top two graphs show the history of the employer contribution as a percentage of pay and a history of the funded ratios.
You know, in your first chart on the employer contribution rates, you for 2006, you have two numbers. You have the 9% and you have the revised. I assume that's because of the Buck situation.
Yes.
But nobody actually put in the 6% difference.
Right. We just wanted to show that when we went from 2006 to 2008, you actually had a decrease in cost when you made the changes to your amortization policy and transferred the assets from your, you know, non-valuation to your valuation reserves. You still had an increase in the cost, though, from 2006 to 2008 because of the investment losses. So we kind of wanted to give you a sense of, you know, 2006 results as if you had used what we consider to be more reasonable assumptions, and then how did that go from there to 2008 and then 2009. Also, because if you look in our, I think if you look in that schedule that has the funded ratios and everything, we did restate, you know, for the GASB, we showed what the results would have been under the 2006 revised assumptions. Looking on page 3, we have the member contributions. Now, these are the average rates, so these are weight, you know, your employee contribution rates depend on the member's tier and what their average and what their age at hire is. We're also calculating an average rate, which is weighted by, you know, the number of people contributing and you know what year they were hired and how much they're being paid. So it's about just under 8% for county and just under 9% for series. Series has a higher percentage of safety employees, I believe. And again, you're looking at a projection in the dollar terms going from 2011 to 2012 of about $22 million down to $20 million. And again, that's reflecting a lower pay base over which people are contributing.
How come the average rate changed that much? Is it the demographics of the group from year to year?
Generally it is.
Okay.
Yes. It also can have to do with how many people who had 30 years of service who weren't contributing, to the extent that they're dropping off. If they're no longer, you know, part of the workforce, mm-hmm. the average can go up. So if you had, you know, a number mm-hmm. of your 30-plus people leaving. Investment earnings. You know, that's a bright story. You had a 22.1% market return in 2011, but again, that led to an actuarial smooth value of assets of only 3.5%. And the return on the valuation assets, that's the assets excluding the contingency reserve and other non-valuation accounts, returned 4.2%. And it's based on an 8% assumption. And again, we have no unrecognized gains or losses anymore. We've reset the actual value of assets. We have a comparison of total payroll, which again declined slightly by about $10 million from 2010 to 2011. And that's covered projected payroll. So that's payroll projected for the next year.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Sure.
So since the since we've got a lot of smoothing left here now, what do you think, How low can the return be for 2011, 2012 before we see a significant increase in the employer rate?
So basically, take any loss that you have, right? To if we assume that you're going to earn 8 and you only earn 6, that's a 2%. Or let's do a number divisible by 5. Let's say you earn 3%, right? So you have a 5% loss. You're only going to recognize 20% of that. So you're going to only have a 1% loss on your assets. Now, your assets are probably around eight times your pay at this point, right?
A little under 8, yeah.
Right, so 1% comes more like an 8% loss in terms of total payroll. And usually when we try to amortize the unfunded liability, figure dividing by a factor of, well, usually 10, but you've got a really long amortization 12, period, so something like 12, 15. Yeah. Looking about a 0.5% change in pay.
And that's with a 5% or a 3% return.
Right.
5% loss.
Yeah. So that's pretty healthy.
We could have done that much easier if you just plugged that number into my spreadsheet. I don't have to do all this math in my head.
And I couldn't see a squirm of it.
And you brought that up. So the liability is about 0.5%.
Yeah, exactly. That's some comfort there. Mm-hmm.
So if we do better than our 8%, what does that do for us?
First of all, I want to invest with you. Again, the exact opposite, right? So just take whatever you have, whatever you earn above 8, divide that by 5. That's what will be impacting next year's contribution rate. And then you divide that by a factor of, well, multiply it by a factor of 8, and then divide it by a factor of 15. So just divide it by 2.
Okay. So I'm not sure when I ask this question, but I think it will be. Every time you read the newspaper, you hear about CalPERS, STRS, everyone else saying 8% is just outrageous as a rate. And they're all saying go down to 7.5 or even 7 is so horrible. And some of the people like Buffett say 6. But even the big giant pension funds are saying 7.5. So are we just kidding ourselves?
So I think
there's something in today's paper that CalPERS went down to 7.75.
Yes, yesterday they lowered their expected return to 7.5. They assumed inflation.
And there was a number in there of how much it increased the state liability if it stayed at 7.75 versus 7.5.
Right, 475. But that would have been a 50 basis point decrease.
So they did lower to 7.5. They assume a much lower inflation assumption than you do. So you have an assumption right now of 3.5% long-term inflation. And really what matters for determining the cost of the plan is what we call the real rate of return. And the real rate of return is your nominal rate minus your inflation assumption. So for your plan, that's about 4.5%, right? 8% minus 3.5%. CalPERS, I think they had suggested a 2.75% inflation assumption.
Right.
So their 7.5% minus 2.75 actually results in a 4.75% real rate of return. So that's actually higher than the real rate of return assumption that you have currently. And the reason that the real return matters more is because if inflation goes up, your returns might go up, but your liabilities are also going to go up, right? Because pay in the long run will go up and your COLAs will be higher. So that's why it's the difference between what your returns are and what inflation are that really matter the most in terms of your cost impact. Does that make sense?
Okay, now their actuary recommended going down to 7.25.
7.25. So his recommendation was if you wanted no margin for future bad experience, 7.5 is okay. If you wanted to put a margin in there for future adverse experience, that's when he would recommend 7.25%.
Okay.
So it was basically like, do you want to use your midpoint assumption or do you want to use something that's a little more conservative than midpoint?
So how would we explain that to anybody that the chief actuary of that organization recommended such a substantial drop, they decided not to do it for the full drop, they decided on a part of the drop. And yet the numbers we're seeing are that 7.25, 7.5.
So again, if you want to really, annoy a newspaper reporter and try to like really get at the point of the story, the point of the story is this real rate of return. Your real rate of return is actually lower than CalPERS' real rate of return right now, even with the changes that they've made.
That's an important statement.
The other alternative would be to put us on some sort of comparable basis by lowering that other number.
And next year, you are scheduled to have another experience study, right? We do this every 3 years. These are supposed to represent long-term assumptions that you develop collecting, a good bit of data and working with your professionals. But the board has your opinions on what these assumptions should be. We would generally recommend that you do that kind of study as part of your triennial experience study, which will be starting 3.5 months from now. I think even if you talk to the CalPERS actuaries, or if you talk to people that if you look at the actual standards practice, they talk about a reasonable range for assumptions, I cannot tell you with any great certainty that a return over the next 30 years is going to be 7.5% or 7.75%. I just don't have, you know, nobody should have that level of certainty about what returns are going to be. So we talk about what is a reasonable range of assumptions. And if you look at what investment advisors say, what your investment professionals said just a couple of years ago about your current assumptions, that is within a reasonable range. To the extent that, you know, if you were going to change and pick a number in that range today, would you pick a slightly different number? Yes, that's certainly possible. But the assumptions that you have right now, I would say, are within that reasonable range. And I would say that as part of your triennial experience study, you'll be collecting data from your investment advisor about how has your portfolios changed, how have their expected returns for different asset classes changed, and how have expectations for inflation changed. Remember, we actually made a pretty sizable reduction to your inflation assumption last time. It used to be 4%. We cut that down to 3.5%. We said, look, the markets are actually saying it's something even lower, something perhaps below 3%. But we didn't think it made sense to make too huge of a jump, you know, at one point in time. Now we can revisit that assumption as part of the next experience study in light of, you know, have people's expectations of inflation changed, or are they still pretty low for the medium and even long term?
So is it reasonable then, based on what you just said, to not change our assumption rates, either for inflation or returns, until we actually go through the experience study next year? That it doesn't really make any sense, or it doesn't matter anyway.
You as the board are responsible for the assumptions of the plan. So if you felt strongly that you did not think that the assumptions that you're currently using, you thought they did not represent a reasonable set of assumptions, then you could make a change to the assumptions right now. If the concern is, okay, we're using these assumptions that are overly optimistic and we want the employer to put more money into the plan, there are other ways to do so. The amortization policy would be an easier way to make a change in terms of, and you would have the same impact in terms of, you know, you could have it so you'd get the same amount of dollars in the plan by going to a more conservative amortization policy, and something that would get you honestly closer to that negative amortization line that you still have a good 7 or 8 years before you even get to a point where you're not negatively amortizing the unfunded liability. So if the trustees really felt strongly that you wanted to make a change now, I would probably recommend looking not just at the interest rate assumption, but also the amortization policy.
Okay, but now the interesting thing to me is we're in Phoenix talking to a lot of people around the country. Everybody's focusing on the rate, the 8%, the 7%, everything else. Everybody is talking about being lower and in the 7s, not into the 8s. That becomes a PR issue as much as anything else. We then get into the question of who sets that, which is the board, and we get into what extent it comes from our investment advisor, what we can return, and actuaries. This is the first time I've actually seen in print that the actuary is recommending in CalPERS a particular rate. And I don't understand if your field as a field normally does that.
Well, we actually made a recommendation as part of your last experience study in print. And to be honest, the chief actuary for CalPERS, he made the same recommendation last year.
So it is common for a field to come in and say, we recommend an 8 or we recommend a 7.5 or we have a commitment.
We'll talk to you about what we think a reasonable range could be.
Well, that's different than a recommended particular number.
And then we may also, within that reasonable range, also recommend it.
Okay. So then we have Stanford coming out with this wonderful study, which the rest of the country is saying California is crazy to be in this position. With huge numbers are significantly less, partly because, as you're describing, it depends on other factors.
There's a lot of bad math in that Stanford study.
Well,
most of it having to do with inflation.
I won't argue about what is right or wrong, bad or good. I will say that it leaves us in a very high number where the press and everybody else in the rest of the country is saying, you can't be in the 8s, you have to be in the 7s. So right or wrong, we're out there on a limb.
And I guess that's what calls to the fore the value of informing the public on realities.
That's the question.
It's dumb public, they don't read the newspapers, right?
I don't dispute anything you said about
that. Informing is one thing, convincing is something else.
I don't dispute that there's certainly...
Facts.
pressure to reduce return assumptions. And a lot of boards that I've worked with, I have one plan that just reduced their return assumption from 7.75 to 7.5%. They have a lower inflation assumption than you do. They did it as part of their triennial experience study, and they had, and we think that normally is the most logical time to do that. But if the board feels strongly that that assumption is not something that you're comfortable with for the current valuation, you know, this is your assumption.
Okay, so put another way then, kind of like what Mike was saying, is can I get cover, whatever you might say, their actuary is recommending 7.25, but you as our actuary, given our plan, are recommending 8.
I never
heard him recommend
that. That's what I want to get to. I want to get to, if I'm going to have to deal with the reality of, well, this was recommended here, what are you guys doing? We as a board decided this was right. It was based partly on, well, they went from their actuary. Do we go to our actuary?
Where's your point here, Gordon?
Can I say something?
I'd like to know. Are you trying to trap the actuary?
No, I'm trying to understand what he would recommend.
We hire him for his advice and his knowledge, and he's doing a great job as far as I can tell. I don't know what your point is. Where are you going with it?
I'll stay out. This is what I would say, Gordon, to answer your question, if some of you were to ask me. This organization realizes that there are economic headwinds afoot, and that these headwinds could very well decrease our expected return, our actual return on the portfolio, and we are 2 to 3 months away from undertaking a rigorous study on capital market expectations and inflation, and we plan on bringing something back in the fall of this year that will set the discount rate going forward after we've taken a hard and meticulous look at this and looked at it with some theoretical underpinnings. I think it's wrong to sit there and just say, sit around this table right now and say, I think we should lower the discount rate. I think there needs to be some mathematical rigor and some theoretical research done before we come back and say, this is what we want to do. But we do realize, as an organization, that we may need to lower the discount rate.
I think the important thing that was stated was the comparison of the two numbers that hadn't come out. And I think that's the completely logical position for us to be. When you take the rate of inflation away from that expected rate, that's the number we're looking at. We're more conservative than all the ones in the media right now.
That's the one too that the Stanford study has tripped up on, and that actually there's an actuarial organization that's going to be responding to those studies and the Rao studies, because when they use those really conservative discount rates of like 4 or 5%, they're basing that on the inflation assumption that the market has right now, which is probably somewhere around 2 or 2.5%. But then they're taking liability numbers from you, you know, from your actuarial projections, and they're not adjusting for the fact that your inflation assumptions are 1.5% to 2% in some cases, higher than the numbers that are underlying their asset projections.
I agree with Rick. I think our actuarial process is working exactly right now, and that we shouldn't jump to any wild conclusions and allow the process to work based on fear and pessimism that might be in the environment. So let's stay the course and see where it goes.
We're going to relook at this. We're going to take a hard look at it later on. And we may very well come back with a much lower discount rate.
Just sort of finishing up this document, we've got a projections of benefit payments and number of paper receiving members, receiving payments. The last page lays out the actuarial assumptions and methods, including the 5-year smoothing of the gains or losses, and it just discloses that we reset the actuarial value to equal the market value this year. And again, you've got a 25-year remaining amortization period. The board did at the last meeting that I was at, you know, indicate that they wanted to make that now a closed period, so next year that would be a 24-year period. At some point, you know, we'll be talking more about the GASB issues as those come through, things that GASB is doing in terms of how you need to calculate your discount rate for your financial disclosure statements. They have to use this blended rate, which really would behoove you to make some changes in terms of smaller amortization periods. But again, that's something that we can discuss as, you know, as those GASB statements become more concrete. Really, that I think this really tries to summarize what we see as the most important information from the, you know, from the book of sleep. To the extent that you have questions on individual exhibits, you know, it summarizes, it has more information summarizing data and assumptions that we use. We also added one small exhibit this year that got at, sort of disclosed the asset to payroll and asset to liability ratios. But I think Rick made a pretty substantial presentation on those to you at your last board study session. So unless there are any questions on that, you know, I'm happy to just defer to what he had shown you at the last meeting. And happy to address any other questions on the report.
Any other questions?
I'd just like to state that I really appreciate this.
Okay.
An executive summary, and it makes for a much better presentation than trying to wade through this.
We were thinking of laminating it in terms of and making it into placemats, but then we didn't want you to get sick when you ate. So,
do we need to have a motion to approve this?
Also, yes. Second.
Second. Motion's made and seconded to accept the actuary's report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Opposed.
Motion's carried. Where's that button?
Thanks, Graham.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll now move on. Update on vacant office space.
So just a quick update on what's going on there. The news is very good. We are just going back and forth right now with some minor changes to the contract. And my instincts tell me we'll have a signed contract to bring back to you on the 27th of March. So things are looking really good. And we're working very close with the Raymond James official. And it's been a very cordial relationship up to this point.
See the advertisement in the paper?
Or you want to
no.
Get it done?
There was a statement by the Raymond James company that they were coming back. Well,
really?
They didn't list an address yet.
Just a statement
they're
coming.
Nice.
Where did you see that?
Yeah.
Oh, it would have been like Sunday or Monday, maybe?
Wall Street?
No.
The B?
Yeah, the B.
Oh.
Just about yay big.
I can't believe I missed it.
Item 6D, this is the discussion in action on the disposition of the duties of the alternate retiree member.
Okay. May I speak?
Hey, before
sure.
We do that, I've got a request.
If you would prefer sorry. Discussing this in I, my absence, I
no.
would be, I will excuse myself if it's, you don't care, I'll stay.
It doesn't bother me if you're here at all. I would like to take I've had a request for about a 2-minute break.
All that talk prior changed my assumption, so I've got
so we'll reconvene in just a couple of minutes. You can stay. A long 2-minute break, and we will now go to 6D.
So item 6D is disposition of the duties of the alternate retiring member. I'll give you a little background and then tell you about a little change that occurred just a few hours ago with respect to this item. So late last year, we had staff starting to look into all our policies. We wanted to find out if there were any policies that had holes in them, any of them that needed revising or whatnot. And staff came across this policy. And essentially what happened was, as from what we can tell, this policy has never been revoked by the board, and theoretically it's still in place today. So a brief history is in June of 2003, the board adopted 315.20.5, which laid out the duties of the alternate retiree member. And in August 13, 2003, at that time, the board also approved a position description for this alternate retiree. And three of the things that we noted that stood out the most to us is that when this position description essentially said when the retiree member is present, the alternate shall not participate in board discussions, that training conferences were limited to SACRs and CALIPARs, and the alternate member would only be compensated if the retiree member were absent. We also looked at the receipts based on research and found that the policy was followed until about December of 2004, and then January of 2005, it seems like the alternate started receiving the $100 a meeting but was not permitted to participate in the discussions. Well, what we found just a few hours ago, Fred brought it to our attention, is that the 37 Act
code that set this these policies essentially was revised last year. And so the policy before gave the board the right to create their own policies, essentially, and administer it the way they want. That part of the code has now been taken out. So essentially, this is a moot point at this time. We are bound to abide by 31520.5. And so my suggestion and recommendation for you today is to simply revoke the policy, even though it's probably invalid, is to revoke it. And do they need to ratify the retro payments?
No, because I just looked at the most recent revision. And the most recent revision basically made the statute mandatory. It did not allow the board to pass a policy contrary to the statute.
So do they need, need to do anything?
But before that, the statute, I believe, was revised in 2005 that allowed compensation to the alternate member.
Okay.
And so, no, the board doesn't need to take action because the statute, you know, trumps the
Perfect.
Board policy.
All right, so there's really nothing that we need to do.
I think we should be allowed to vote on Joan.
We could take a popularity vote.
So,
do we like
the way I read this, then the alternate's allowed to attend conferences.
Yes.
And,
okay,
this
and,
is
I think that's only right, because how can you have an alternate that's ready to go for a meeting if you can't attend any conferences or participate in the meetings?
Right.
And,
you're allowed to do
I would
that.
Agree with that. So
there's nothing that we really need to do here.
Okay, that's good. Saves us a half hour.
Yep.
Okay, 6E.
Item 6E, discussion and action on whether to respond to the Stanford Institute. Just a brief review of what went on here. On the 21st of February, the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research put out a study titled More Pension Math. And the study focused on 24 systems across California, 20 of which were our own 37 Act systems. It looked at each system individually and in the aggregate, and essentially in the aggregate it said that we're using too high a discount rate, that we are undervaluing or underreporting our liabilities, and it also reported that the aggregate unfunded liability is about $135 billion. It also ranked each system side by side in terms of certain categories, members, retiree, average retiree benefit, average funded ratio, and so forth. And just to let you know that we fared favorably in most of those categories. There were a couple errors in the report. One error said that Tier 5 benefits were still open to new members, which is not the case. And they also said that members were allowed to choose whether to participate in Social Security. The only real issue I had with this study is that the way they calculated the average annual pension cost or the increase in pension cost over time, I looked at all the data of our pension costs for the last 21 years, and coincidentally enough, they chose the specific year that would produce the highest number. There was no other year that I could start with and calculate the average annual growth in pension costs that would give me a higher number than 1999. They tried to justify this by saying that it was the last time that counties had essentially a surplus in their budgets and so forth. But coincidentally enough, that came on the heels of one of the biggest boom markets we had in the stock market, and revenues were very high at that time. So it's no wonder that that was the last time that there were budget surpluses. So I think that they were a little... I just don't think it was fair to pick that as a point in time. But that's really my only issue I have with that report. It does bring up concern, some of us were talking earlier today with Graham about the discount rate. If people read that they may think that the pension plans are in trouble and they're not sustainable. There is an attachment that explains and answers some of the common questions about the discount rate and why we are still very sustainable and viable. And my suggestion to you would be that if you were to respond, and I don't necessarily think it's necessarily a good idea, this stuff, and I think I alluded to in the agenda item, this is nothing new. There's really nothing new in this agenda item that nobody hasn't heard already before. They've been saying this for the last two or three years, and other than the errors that the report quoted about Stan Sarah, I don't really think this is anything to get extremely worried about.
Didn't you or Graham say that there was a rebuttal report coming out by another entity?
Since this agenda item has been put together, there has been two rebuttals. Orange County has rebutted to the authors, and like we thought, they are now engaged in a back and forth with the authors on this, and it's being published in the Orange County Register. San Diego County has responded, but their response was, shall I say, a typical CalPERS response. They're just quoting their past returns, and they're saying that everything they're doing is just fine. So they're kind of just like window dressing the topic. Those are the only two responses I've seen so far. So I have a feeling that for the most part, people are pretty much thinking like I am, that this is just not a big deal. And I guess my point to you is that I think that there's probably a little more risk involved in responding to this and starting up something that we just don't want to engage in right now. And but if you do, if we do respond, I would recommend just addressing the errors and just addressing it to the authors of the study.
I think they want you to respond.
I do too.
Well, I'd say don't.
If they had an agenda with what they wanted to see as an outcome, then you're not going to change that.
No. I think, Rick, if anyone inquires of you, of the press or anyone else, what do you think about what Stanford said about Stancera? You respond to whoever made the inquiry.
Okay.
How about if we have Rick write a letter to the board, just a response to that, and we put it in the file?
And I actually have written something up.
And if somebody asks, he can just say, this is what I gave to the board.
Isn't that essentially...
It's pretty close to what you have.
Yeah. Rick, wasn't there a difference between the low point that they picked out as far as employer contributions and then the high point and then projecting their growth, but the high point was both employer and employee contributions?
Yes. Here's the problem. I know what you're talking about. That was my original thought, what happened. They quoted a number, they quoted a pension or an increase in our annual cost based on the ARC, the required contribution laid out by the actuary. My response to them would be, unfortunately, this board, the ARC is not the thing to use to calculate the annual growth and pension costs, because over the years, this board has been setting aside excess earnings into a contingency reserve, and that contingency reserve built up quite a bit over the last several years, and the ARC that the actuary calculates does not take that into account. And so over the last 3 years, the county has been able to benefit from the prudence of this board by setting aside money and actually lowering the contribution that they actually paid. Well, the study said, we don't care about that. We want something, a number that's consistent from year to year, and so we're going to use the ARC. That's totally unfair, because the ARC also is arbitrarily high because we have been taking aside earnings, setting them aside, and not using them in the calculation of the ARC. So it's an unfair portrayal of our actual costs and the increase in cost just using the ARC. And so that's noted in the letter as well if we do want to respond. But that's really a totally unfair depiction of our growth and cost, because this board has been doing prudent stuff over the years prior to the last three.
Right.
I think that's a term of art that no one would ever understand outside.
The art? It's what the actuary tells you to pay. But anyway.
And the reserve is gone.
Pardon me?
And the reserve is gone.
There is still a $23.8 million in the 2% contingency reserve.
Okay. You know, the only thing that's scary to me is a lot of, wherever you go, conferences and so forth, people just keep referring back to this report. And what frightens me is it becomes gospel and goes to, you know, the legislators who are going to make subsequent decisions based on what to some degree may be incorrect information. So, and that's the part that concerns me. The fact whether you respond back to the authors or not probably doesn't make any difference. And I honestly don't have a solution. But I'm just saying that, you know, this is the kind of stuff that drives policy. And that's
like
the sad part.
Of mass destruction.
Thank you.
the pension commission that's meeting in the legislative committee that's meeting that had that last meeting, like 4.5 hours. There was a, not this Stanford report, but a previous Stanford report that was out. And by and large, the majority
members on the commission were skeptical of the conclusions drawn in that initial Stanford report, and were particularly critical of Joe Nation, saying he had an agenda that was not theirs.
Joe Nation's only agenda is that he's an economist, and the economists view a liability different than a pension plan and an actuary that's trying to fund that plan. And that's the difference, is that it's the interpretation of what the discount rate represents. And that's the problem that we're facing, is because we're both right. Both of these interpretations are right, but it depends on what your perspective is. And without getting into a long story about this, our discount rate is based on how much money we need to fund the benefits. And it's based on what we think the assets are going to earn. The economists think that the liability should be valued from an economic perspective, in terms of, if you or I had to go out in the private sector and go to an insurance company and buy this benefit, would the insurance companies use an 8% discount rate? Heck no, because they can't afford to take the risk. So the economists say that the discount rate should be used, that we should be using, should be one that's not risk-based. We should not be taking any risk to fund these benefits, because these benefits have been promised to the employees and they're going to get paid come hell or high water, for lack of a better word. So it's a matter of how much risk you want to take, and that's the different perspectives in the discount rate.
The insurance companies also build in profit.
They do.
And we don't have a profit.
They do. But we're assumed that we're going to be around 10, 20, 50, 100 years from now, and so we assume that we're going to earn this expected return on assets, and that allows us to do this.
Well, but what Nation and that group are saying is that if their scenario pans out rather than yours, that the public is going to be responsible, the taxpayer is going to be responsible for the difference.
I agree.
And that's their beef.
But what makes them think that, based on the way we invest, that we're only going to earn 5%? I mean, their opinion is no better than mine.
But this is not an argument you want in the press.
It's not. You can't win this argument. You will not win this argument.
And you can't win it.
What
do we decide
to do?
In an election year, this is
just
crazy.
We're kind of like just sitting
around. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that the other bottom line is this, that nothing is going to change in Sacramento in the next few years. The governor's proposal is going nowhere.
What are we voting?
And it doesn't seem like the legislature is anxious to take this on.
I just need direction on if you want
no
me to.
Action. Okay.
No, I like Jeff's. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah, so do I. Why don't you just send a letter to the board?
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to.
Which is pretty much what you've got in here already.
Kind of like letter to sample letter they sent out a few weeks ago.
And I move the executive director to send a letter to each board member explaining his, or giving his analysis of the Stanford report as it relates to SAMHSA.
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Motion's made and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. And then we're not going to release that letter to the press
right.
Either. Okay. Sackers, discussion of Sackers May 8th to 11th conference.
That's me. Every year when we go to Sackers for the spring conference, we need, customarily it's either the chair and the vice chair, who are the voting delegates. For this spring conference, Darren is going as vice chair. The chair is not going. We do have four other members
that are for re-election.
And so we just depend on who would like to be the alternate voting delegate. Darren would be the voting delegate as vice chair. And then Maria or Gordon, Michael, and Donna are going.
You want it, Maria?
As far as newness goes.
I would suggest that the senior board member of that group.
It's like, hey.
The longest serving.
Yes,
thank
exactly.
You.
Exactly. Longest
that's
serving.
That's
board.
Fine.
And so the motion, we need a motion and second to designate Darren as the voting delegate, Maria as the alternate.
Yeah, I'll
so
make a
move.
Motion.
Second. So we have a motion and a second.
Motion made and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion is carried.
Okay, which brings
thanks
us to the next item, which is the recommended ballot from the Sackers Nominating Committee. We get this each year, and as you can see, this is not the final ballot. It's just a recommended. They're asking systems to, if they want to write in a candidate. What we've done in past practice is there's no action taken usually unless you want to write in a candidate, because we will get the final ballot April 1st. So it's up to you whether you want a motion and second to approve it, even though it's just the recommended. The other systems could perhaps write in candidates, or no action taken.
Well, we usually don't take a position on this.
Past practice. I mean, I think we've approved it 4 or 5 years ago, but really the final one does not come until April 1st. So.
You're not talking about doing anything about the proposed bylaw changes, just the officers.
The members. Correct. Darren will be going to this business meeting as the voting delegate, and there will be a ballot that you guys will see prior to April 1st. So then you can direct him on how you want to vote.
Okay, no action, okay, for everybody?
Okay. Okay. Best judgment.
Okay, members forum. Darren?
Well, Mike, chime in when you need to, or feel free or whatever, or cut me off. Mike and I went to the Calipers in Palm Springs. I think it gives you a little better perspective or different perspective than Sackers, just because you're getting all of the systems in California that are there, the charter city systems, the ones that are represented by CalPERS. You get CalPERS there, CalSTRS, so you get a very good representation. I think the one item that staff was interested in getting a report back on was the presentation that we got here recently, which is on the iPad, the electronic medium for distribution. I know some board members have already gone to that. Real quick, in a nutshell, I think when you sat and listened to the presentation, I think Joan's comments are dead on when you look at the analysis, the cost-benefit analysis on this, and they look at staff time. I mean, they really had to admit finally that, yeah, those costs, staff costs that they use, they're baked in anyway. So whether they're preparing these things or not, the staff cost is going to be there. So I think once you eliminate that portion of it, and then you break down some of the other costs, Mike, their postage and emailing costs on the median were really high.
Yeah.
So we do the website.
To look at the cost, part of the cost benefit analysis, back to your point from the prior meeting. So, and then it really is a individual member benefit if you choose to go to this type of delivery of your agendas and information. You've got to set up, as Joyce pointed out, you've got to set up firewalls, you've got to set up security protocols, password protected because of the sensitive information with service-connected disability, the medical information, even the limited amount that we get would have to be password and firewall protected. So there's costs there. One county, Fresno County, went through their county IT, so they implemented it at a much reduced cost compared to everybody else. But the, iPad, just to get the iPad and buy them and download, I think the average or median cost was somewhere, Mike, around $800 to $900 per board member. And again, once you back...
Oh, between the iPad and the software?
Yeah. So, and the biggest expense was obviously the iPad device. So, really it just comes down to, collectively as a board, if we feel that between all of us, this is a path we want to go down, then it's something you pull the trigger on. If the majority of people just say, look, I'm happy getting this part and I want my stuff in hard copy. The other biggest other ongoing expense was they found out, each system that was there found out that because a lot of the members didn't have wireless connection at their home, that you would have to pay for the 3G or 4G service. And that was Mike, unlimited, that was on average, median was about $40 a month.
Yeah.
So you're
paying $25
for yours.
For $2 million.
Okay. So for the unlimited, it was, I think, you know, it was like $35, $40 a month per member, which most recommended that if, you know, if you're going to have this as your official process, you probably need to provide that on an unlimited basis. And
I don't mind using, putting it all on electronic devices, but I don't want Stansera only an electronic device, because I also use it for personal stuff. So how do we draw that line?
Well, again, you would have to adopt, you know, a whole policy. You'd have to adopt an electronic media or electronic media device policy. You know, all these systems had to do that, with an emphasis being on the security portion of it. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say for those of us, I'm not going to speak for Donna here, but in our department, we have the internal security and firewall and so forth. We have an encryption ability, and I personally would prefer to get them via soft copy. I don't care whether I have an iPad or not. I spend a lot of time at work, so a little bit more won't necessarily hurt. I don't have a personal iPad yet. Probably go with the Kindle Fire.
Well, keep in mind, you know, when you're looking at the cost benefit analysis of adopting this, that all of the systems that adopted this, once they pulled the trigger and said this is it, there were no more paper copies. That was it.
I think the one analysis that hasn't been done, maybe you did it and it was just shared. I don't know. What is it costing us to make this batch?
Staff time and paper time.
We're going to bring this back.
But
I think that's the other side of the ledger that needs to be there.
It is there, but I think the point that has to be made is unless we're going to, you know, carve out and cut staff hours or reduce staff hours, those staff hours, they're going to be doing something else. So they're baked in no matter what. That's my point.
The bottom line.
I mean, realistically.
It's hard to argue with.
Realistically, that's the point.
Before we go on, can I say one thing? We are going to discuss this in depth on the 27th.
Okay.
And I'm sure what you're talking about will be brought up.
Okay.
One thing I do want to mention, though, is that they did say that because it's electronic, they can check and see when you opened and looked at your board package.
Darn.
Yeah.
If you did.
Yeah.
I think in the end, what we concluded last time was the copying is an insignificant cost compared to the staff time.
Right.
So but there was no action taken. I think we wanted Jeff to be around.
Remember, I've been put. Anything else?
Yeah, just one other thing. It was interesting. There was a presentation on, and this is something Gordon's brought up in the past. Paul, our investment advisor consultant, has talked about it. They did a really good presentation on from the crash till now, and then even before the crash till now, if you were basically in just an electronic index fund. So there was no, you know, you take beta, you take alpha out of the equation, and it was very interesting to see what your end result was as far as what your gains were. Back to, I think, what Rick brought up about when you run that modeling, the amount of risk that you have in your overall portfolio. And then that same individual, the modeling he used, I mean, obviously he's selling a product, but it was interesting that he had a lot of long-short strategies within that product, both on the equity side and the fixed income side. He was recommending, you know, a long short and all those different asset classes. So I thought that was very
shorted fixed income.
Yeah, I mean it was very interesting how he came up with that, but it was a pretty good. So Mike, anything I'm leaving off?
Yes, certainly the actuarial panel that you didn't know. Darren's not a fan of the actuarial panel, but this was the California actuarial panel. Advisory panel, and our own Graham is on that panel,
right.
And so I think that speaks to who we have working for us. And they I'm going to assume the things that the panel recommended in their presentation that we're going to be doing since Graham is on that panel. And that was an interesting presentation. It was, and I like the modeling that Darren was talking about. Other than that, it was a very interesting presentation, interesting group, very dynamic. The one model that I like, and I noticed, and I'm not going to fault Rick for this, but the guy, his is not static. He's got these little balls that jump around that go from year to year.
Well, I had those little lines of scenarios.
These are actually moving. And it's kind of, it's mesmerizing. Actually, you can watch all this information projected and booming around up above the line, below the line. It's really cool.
Okay, let's just go down the line there. See if you, are you done? Fred?
No.
Joan?
Nothing.
Jeff? Gordon?
No.
Michael?
Oh, one other thing. They did have a presentation on the secure choice pension. That's the one that they're talking about at a federal level, making a pension plan that small employers can pay into that doesn't involve any taxpayers' dollars. Interesting. Other than that, I'm good.
Supposedly doesn't involve any taxpayer dollars.
Donna?
It doesn't.
Maria?
I went to the La Sarah Roundup. I think that's what they called it. Anyways, it was actually very interesting, very briefly. Almost some of the same players as Sackers. But yeah. On the first day, it was all business, and you had your some money managers and so forth. But on the second day, they included union representatives across the state. So there was a much broader discussion and debate and question than you would get at Sackers, which is pretty, you know, pretty structured, well structured. A little bit more informal, good presentations. I was impressed. I certainly recommend it for us, for anybody who's interested to go next year. It's a different perspective.
Mike?
Oh, no.
And staff?
Thank you. Nothing.
Rick? Okay, and I have nothing. So that brings us to item 8. Jeremy.
Good
morning.
Where
are you
going? Yeah,
Will and I came up. I looked at the logs of the past.
You didn't order your own.
Session.